listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Each week, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Our guest today is Dr. Jared Balmer, a licensed marriage and family therapist with over 30 years' experience working with adolescents and their families. During his professional career, Jared has founded and operated five residential treatment centers. Most recently, he is the co-founder of Island View Residential Treatment Center, the Oakley School, and the Aspen Institute for Behavioral Assessment. Jared lectures to audiences across the country and is a very deserving recipient of the National Leadership Award by the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. Jared, welcome to Answers for the Family.
It's good to be here with you, Alan.
Well, it's great to have you on. I got a chance to go through your PowerPoint presentation in regards to the four-headed monster, and I think you have really hit on something. Why don't you start out by just telling our listeners a little bit about the components that make up the four-headed monster?
Well, you know, as you know, I've been working with adolescents for the last 30 years, but I think particularly in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we're seeing some unique problems that an adolescent will confront. And I think those problems all converge into what I sort of refer to as the perfect storm, or sometimes I refer to it as the four-headed monster. And those variables or those issues are virtual or electronic networking, which some kids really go, you know, overboard and make the problems associated with it. The other one is a lack of coping skills. I think most adolescent therapists or people that work with adolescents would agree that there is an increase of lack of coping skills with adolescents, and many sort of have difficulty growing up and coping with stress. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the other variable. The other one is what I call the paradox of choice. We kind of live in a society where we have more choices than we had ever before. But there's some research that would indicate that the more choices we have, the more difficult it is for us to manage these choices, and then as a result, oftentimes, the more choices we have, the less satisfied we are with the choices, because there's always another choice at the horizon. So I'm always questioning myself, did I really make the right choice, and maybe my satisfaction level with the choice I made may not be as good.
Right.
And then sort of the fourth issue is one certainly that's been around for a long time, and that is the sexualization of youth, particularly young women today. So those sort of four variables is certainly a great concern, I think, for any parent and any adolescent out there today.
Well, now, let's start with as far as the socialization. I think the main question is why? I mean, if socialization leads to a well-adjusted personality, why then do many experts blame virtual networking for the increase in the suicide rate amongst teens?
Well, that's a very excellent question. In my PowerPoint, you will see that I have given you some statistics about suicide rates, for instance. And really, over the last 2 decades, 3 decades, The statistics are such that we have seen a progressive slight decrease in suicide rates among folks that are 20 years and younger. But recently published in the AMA journal, the American Medical Association journal, was an article about reporting a sharp increase in suicide rates of about 8, which is quite significant.
Oh yeah,
yeah, it's really a significant increase, and they're telling us that the reason for that is what they think is a sharp increase in electronic social networking, texting, Twitter, and all of the stuff that the kids do on the computer. And so, of course, that begs the question that you're asking is, you know, if socialization makes for a well-adjusted kid, why does this virtual socialization lead to suicide? What's wrong with social, you know, with virtual socialization? And of course, on closer examination, we begin to sort of peel back the onions and find out what's really wrong with it. And there's a number of variables, I think, that are worth discussing. One is that the child becomes, the adolescent, or even the child, becomes over-dependent on the peer group.
Mm-hmm.
There is a constant checking with my peers as to what they think, what they do, and so on and so forth. You will see kids, you know, texting, you know, endlessly. They're glued to their cell phones, and everything they do, they check with each other. So the kid, if you will, is lacking independent decision making skills, because I got to check with everybody,
right,
about what I do and watch your feedback and what do you think and so on and so forth. So a lack of independent decision making. At the same time, there is a lack of nonverbal communication skills. As we all know, communication, for the most part, is really a nonverbal affair. We sort of signal to each other nonverbally as to what we or how we need to interpret each other's messages. The tone of voice, the inflection in our voice tone, and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
All are part and a very critical and essential part of communication. All of that is not there when we text each other or when we are, you know, Twittering each other. So the child, if you will, is not really developing nonverbal communication skills. Another factor is excessive catharsis. We know for a fact that kids that electronically socialize are apt to tell each other much more or to reveal more of themselves than they would otherwise. It's much easier to sort of hang my dirty laundry out there if I don't look at you.
Yeah,
and so there is this excessive catharsis, you know, where people hang out their not so clean laundries with each other. That's a problem.
Well, and I think you have it, and not only so much with people hanging out their own, but we're now having cases that are hitting the national news of people that are hanging out other people's to the point that it's causing, and there's been some suicides just based on information that have been provided from one child to the other, and in some cases it wasn't even true.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. So, you know, it's a wonderful way to gossip. And I don't have to look you in the face, so I'm a little more risque with my gossip. and I tell a bunch of lies, if you will. I don't even know that they're lies. I'm just passing on the information. Mm-hmm. And you could really get caught in the crosshair, so to speak, and be greatly damaged emotionally, and can even lead, like you're suggesting, to suicide.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Now, I was going to say, now you mentioned about your PowerPoint presentation. I just want to let everybody know, if anybody wants to get a copy of that, some of the things that we're talking about are from that. It's called The Four-Headed Monster, but if you go to our site, which is www.answers4thefamilyblog.com, and you click on Jared's photo, you follow the instructions, you'll be able to either watch it, or you can download it yourself, and that'll help you. So if you have any other questions, go to that, get a copy of it, and if you want, even if you want to do it now during the show, that's part of what we'll be addressing.
Okay.
So anyway,
you know, the other thing, Alan, I was going to mention too is the that overall, basically, that because of this. The actual social skills of adolescents is declining and not increasing.
Yep.
Because of this electronic virtual networking. And recently, I think it was Stanford put a study together that showed that there is a sort of a direct relationship between the personal social isolation that you feel is increasing along with the increase of time you spend social networking. In other words, the more you are Twittering and the more you are texting, the more you feel socially isolated, which is sort of paradoxical, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. No, and in fact, it's also bringing about even a new industry. One of our guests that we had on has a company where they send out young people to major corporations to train their young employees to get off of the social networking, and to learn how to interact with people more face to face because they're starting to lose that skill.
So, exactly,
which goes right into what you're saying.
Yeah. And so, you know, that sort of begs the question, what drives this madness? What drives this obsession? You know, I talk to parents all the time, and they're telling me my kid is, if I take the cell phone away from my kid, he's ready to kill me, you know? That cell phone is the connection to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if I take that away, then, we got some real conflict. So that begs the question, what drives this obsession? And, of course, people working with adolescents will know that adolescence is a sort of period of identity formation. I don't think there is any other time in a person's life where a person is sort of wants to find out, who am I, you know?
Right.
What is it I'm all about? And of course, the way we do that is not necessarily by internal reflection, so to speak, but we do it by comparison. So I compare myself to significant others. I compare myself to my family members. I compare myself to the peer group. And some people compare themselves to maybe the divine, you know, the spiritual aspect in their lives.
Right.
But particularly during adolescence, the peer group is huge. It's the overarching, overwhelming group where the kid is comparing himself, and this is what drives this madness. So there's this incredible need to belong, you know. If I just, you know, how many parents have you talked to, Alan, that say, you know, my kid rather belongs to the parking lot kids that are hanging out there and, you know, doing the wrong thing. It's much better to belong to those folks than not to belong at all.
Well, and you're absolutely right. That is, that is their new family to them, or those people that they are meeting on the streets is kind of what it used to be. Now, their new family is someone that they haven't even met in person. It's somebody they've been texting with or in some way networking with them over the internet. So now you have somebody who's their family that they really don't know. They don't know that that person isn't a complete imposter. You know, they may be texting and or contacting over the internet someone who they think is a girl and has sent them pictures of a girl, and it might be a 50-year-old man. You know, so
exactly.
So there's so many other things going on that is potentially dangerous if they really don't know what's going on. But what I was going to say is this kind of plays right into a question that was emailed to us. Emailed in regards for you, and this one says, It says, my daughter reflects so much of what I read on your PowerPoint that I downloaded from the website. It says, At 16, she will barely go out of the house except to meet with her friends or go to school. She is hooked on her iPod, and every minute she is not sleeping or watching television, she is either listening to the iPod or she is texting someone or in contact with one of her friends. It says her temperament has become very negative about everything, and they have recently taken her to doctors who have put her on medication to deal with her depression. It says you have identified the problem so well. What do you suggest parents such as myself do to change this situation?
Well, I think the medication is not really curing this problem. You know, you got to understand, I'm a great believer in medication for the right kid for the right problem. But if this girl, and it sounds like the parents think that this kid is depressed, the only thing that's really going to resolve this problem is to get the girl outside of the home, to get her to interact with real people, not with virtual people, and to somehow come up with a strategy that gets the girl outside and get her to interact with other kids.
Yep.
And of course, you know, a child like that who is depressed probably is very refractory to this, you know, and sometimes you may have to intervene, if it gets really bad, maybe you need to get him out of the house to some kind of day treatment scenario or even a residential treatment scenario. Those are, you know, these are difficult things to do, but when a child is completely isolating herself 24/7, you can well imagine what this kid is going to end up with in a couple of years, you know. So the time is to do something now, you know.
Exactly. Now I wanted to touch on some of the things, also some of the others, especially the one in regards to coping skills. And I just wanted to share with you that I was chastised. I personally was chastised as a room parent when my boys were in grade school for organizing a volleyball game during recess. And what was my crime? My crime was keeping score. So my question is, I mean, what started this lack of competition movement that seems to be such a negative influence on our kids today?
Well, I think that parents, you know, we live in a very competitive environment these days, and it seems like it's getting more and more and more competitive. And I think parents oftentimes ironically say that we must protect our kids, and so that they will not experience real conflict. We don't want them to run into the brick wall, because if they constantly run into the brick wall, they get depressed, they no longer want to try, and so on. And I think that drives this madness. However, the net result is that everybody now gets a first prize. You know, there are no winners, no losers. You know, the Pinewood Derby, everybody comes home with the first prize. I was at a parent the other day, and on a home visit, and the parent showed me that the child's room and the child's room was plastered with trophies. And the parent says to me, well, you know, he never won a first prize, ever. So, you know, we sort of take the bumps and the bruises away from the child in hopes that we're not going to damage him. But in reality, we are teaching him not to compete. You know, if we eliminate competition in hopes of building self-esteem, we're not building self-esteem. A child knows the difference. A child knows the difference whether I got first place or whether I got sixth place. There is no reason for us to sort of make it up to this child and say, look, sixth place is the same as first place. That is not true. It's a lie.
That's right.
It's a lie. And the child knows the difference. You can't develop coping skills in the absence of competition. You can't. It's it goes hand in hand. And a lot of these kids then end up, you know, if a child always was a winner, a child will end up with an overinflated ego. These are kids that become narcissistic. I'm the best. I have never lost. I've never experienced defeat. They can't cope under real stress. They can't deal with disappointment and rejection. And the result, the long-term result of all of this, is depression and anxiety, which we now see in adolescents at a record pace. We have never in the history of this country had more kids that are as depressed and as anxious as they are now.
Okay, well, I guess the main thing is, I mean, what can we start doing as parents or as teachers or as professionals to try to reverse this trend?
Well, I was speaking to a parent group the other day, and this is a good example. I was going to take these youngsters on a mountain biking experience, and about three or four parents were very chittery, and they said, "Well, you know, we don't really want our kids to fall off the bike, and we don't want them to get hurt, and so on and so forth." And I said, "Look, and one of the best things for your child to get self-confidence and to experience, to get self-confidence and to build coping skills is to put them in an adventure environment." And I said, "What is an adventure environment?" I said, "An adventure environment is not taking your child on a water ski trip and have him water ski behind the ski boat all day long. That's not an adventure. That's a great recreational activity. That may build family cohesiveness and all of this stuff. Wonderful. But that's not adventure. Adventure is when a child has or is exposed to some hardship."
Mm-hmm.
"Where a child is exposed to a problem, where a child falls off the bike, where a child has to repair the bike, where a child has to walk, where a child is experiencing some disappointment, some hardship. But overall, it's an exhilarating experience. That's adventure."
Well, exactly. And I think part of it is, and to show that they can overcome it. In other words, you know,
exactly.
They, you know, as they go through this adventure and there is some hardship, but to come out the other side and say, you know what, I got through that. I made it.
To take the hurdle, so to speak, away from the child, because we are afraid that if he jumps over the hurdle, he's going to fall and hurt himself. It's the worst thing we can do to our kids. I think the best thing we can do to our kids, if you want to teach coping skills, is to put lots of hurdles in front of them, not the kinds of hurdles that will inevitably are going to get them, you know, hurt, but obviously there needs to be a safety net, but they must be able to deal with disappointment and confront hardship. And for us to sort of, you know, do take that away from them, we are raising a nation of wimps. Mm-hmm. You know, I see this in school. Johnny comes home with a B-. The mother is apoplectic. She wants to hire an attorney and go to school and raise hell because the teacher dared to give Johnny a B-, because after all, I helped Johnny write that essay, and I think it's worth for an A, at least. You see what I'm saying? So the point is, we're taking all the hurdles away from the child. The child almost must be succeeding. He must get a straight A, must succeed in everything, never experience failure, never walk into the brick wall. If we do that to a child, we are raising a wimp that cannot cope and eventually is depressed and anxious.
Well, and I think to add to that, in the scenario you gave, they also don't have to take responsibility for anything, because in that situation, the parent is going to try to rescue them and blame somebody else rather than sit down with Johnny and go, you know what, maybe you need to work a little harder at this to get the A next time.
Yeah, no question. But I think that's how society has changed, you know. When I went to school and I came home, my behavior wasn't so stellar in school. You know, I was a naughty boy. I came home with a letter from the teacher, and the parent opened the letter, and the letter basically said I was a naughty boy. And my mother would sit me on the chair, and she would lecture me and tell me how disappointed she was, and you know, and grounded me, and I had to do all kinds of chores in addition to that. Now, you know, the parent goes to school and says, you have no right to discipline my child. Mm-hmm. You know, I dare you, you know, to tell my child that there's something wrong with him. I'm the only person that can tell my child there's something wrong with him.
Right. And in most cases, they won't.
Exactly, yeah, because they're afraid again that if I'm, you know, too negative, I don't want to appear too negative, you know, I must, my child needs to be my best buddy. And so a lot of parents these days want to be their child's best buddy. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. A child needs to be, or I should say a parent needs to be a parent. A parent doesn't need to be the best buddy of a child. A parent needs to be a parent. And there's a difference between being a best buddy of my kid and being a parent.
That's right. Now, we've got another question coming in, and this one's coming in from a high school teacher, English and history teacher in the New Jersey public schools. It says that they've been a teacher for 16 years, and just in the last 5 years, the comprehension and skills of my students have declined measurably. It says, I agree with the fact that virtual networking may be a factor in this trend. Can you explain why and perhaps what teachers can do to help their students?
Well, clearly, I mean, that's, for my money, that is clearly at the base of why we see this decline. You know, there's a number of articles I read over the last 6 months that would suggest that college freshmen, their English skills are declining at a record rate. They can no longer write a decent sentence because they're used to twittering each other. And, of course, when you text each other on the phone, you sort of have your own alphabet, so to speak.
Right.
The English skills are declining because the way we communicate now is by code. And so it, you know, it declines. I think the cure to this really is with the parents. I'm not so sure that the school is in a position to make up the difference. I have a niece, she's a kindergarten teacher, and she's telling me that she has about 20% of kindergartners showing up with cell phones in school. And they're you know, texting each other. And she says she went to the administration and they put out a thing, and they said, no more, you know, no more texts. no more phones. You know, you check into the class, you drop the phone in the basket, and on the way home you can pick it back up, but you don't have it. You know.
Yeah, I can't.
So I am not so sure that we realistically we can burden the school to make up the difference. The burden is with the parents. You know, take the phone away. You know, you don't need this phone. If I can convince my teenager that he can be or she can be socially much more attractive, if I can convince a child that, look, the more you spend time on this virtual interaction stuff, the less socially attractive you become. So if I convince an adolescent that, look, the less you do this, the more socially attractive you become, maybe now the adolescent is willing to maybe spend less time at it, so to speak. So we must make the argument that the less you do this, the more socially attractive you become. That's typically my approach when I deal with them, and most adolescents actually respond to that.
Well, and you're right, because that's what's important to them at that time. And that makes good sense. Now, in speaking about the fact that parents needing to do that, we have another question that came in. Again, another listener question. And again, I want to remind everybody, we appreciate these. And we do everything we can to make sure that we get to them. This one says, as a parent of four kids who are in or close to becoming teens, my one that already is a teen is 15, has already threatened suicide twice. So we felt we had no choice but to place her in a therapeutic program. This was 8 months ago, and we expect she will be coming home soon. We are trying to get ourselves and our children prepared for her return. What are some of the key points you can share with us as we really want to make this transition successful?
That's an excellent question. You know, any transition is hard. A transition, you know, you send your child off to kindergarten for the first time, it's hard. You know, the transition from a child from elementary school to junior high school is hard. To transition from, junior high school to high school is hard. Any transition is hard, and it's particularly hard when a child is coming home from a treatment center. There's a few things that I think would be very, very helpful. Number one is the parents need to get with the treatment team and put together an aftercare plan. What is it exactly that we want to achieve when Johnny comes home? What is it we want to achieve scholastically? What would be the best environment for him? What about his friends? Let's take a close analysis of the friend. This, when the child comes home, this is not the time to negotiate which friends are good friends and which friends are bad friends. That negotiation needs to go on now before the child comes home. Mm-hmm. Anything that can be negotiated now before the child comes home, we're that much further ahead. So a very detailed after plan that includes friends, that includes academics, that includes follow-up therapy, which is a must in my opinion. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a follow-up therapy, and I would not suggest just individual therapy. I would suggest family therapy.
Right.
People need to look each other in the eye with a neutral party there. And help us work through these various issues. All of that needs to be negotiated, talked about in detail before the child comes home. Clearly the child has made some improvements. Clearly the child wants to maintain these improvements, but there's always the pushback, if you will, from the friends. The minute this kid is home, the phone will ring and the old friends are beginning to call. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that is something we want to work through very, very carefully, both at the treatment center before the child comes home and then in a follow-up in a family therapy scenario.
Exactly. And you bring up a great point that I just want to drive home for everybody about the difference between the the individual therapy and the family therapy. The family therapy allows the child to believe that they are part of the family and everybody is looking at what's going on in that family versus the individual therapy where you may be stigmatizing your child to believe they are the problem and they are the only one that needs it. If you as a parent look at it and say, we as a family are going to do this to help our overall happiness, and I think that's the point you're driving home, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, it's that is an excellent point. You know, lots of times the parent or the child experiences a problem and we ship the kid off to see the psychiatrist or to see a counselor. And then the child sort of becomes what we call in the field the identified patient, mm-hmm. where in fact the problem is beyond the child. The problem oftentimes is a family systems problem. Yes, the child manifests the problem, but the problem is found within the dynamics of the family. And if we go in a family therapy scenario, the child gets the message, you know, we're all part of this. We're all part of this, and we got to work together to work this through.
Mm-hmm.
Much better approach than shipping the kid off to see a psychiatrist. That's not really going to, it sort of deals with the symptoms to a degree, but is it really the cure?
That's right. All right. Well, you know what? We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, and Jared, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the paradox of choice. So we're going to take a break for about 1 minute. We will be right back, and we are speaking with Dr. Jared Balmer.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back with Dr. Jared Balmer. And right now I want to ask a little bit about the paradox of choice. And one of the things that I looked at, and for instance, let's talk a little bit about your choice and happiness. And explain why we as Americans have more choices and options in life than probably ever before, and yet we seem to be less happy with our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think in any culture, choice is acquainted with happiness. If you're a prisoner and you have no choice at all, you're not a very happy camper. Choice is equal to happiness to a degree. In other words, if I have lots of choice over my life, if I can choose to do this, or I can choose to enter that profession, or I can choose to get up this time, or to do this, or to do this, and so on and so forth, the more choices I have, the more autonomy I feel, okay? And typically, happiness is associated with the choice,
right? Which is free.
But again, the question is there a point where maybe we have too much of a choice? And that certainly is a question that a lot of people have asked themselves, not just myself. And I think there's a fair amount of research out there. For instance, the Lewis Harris research suggests they did a study in 1966 that said in 1966, 9% of people felt unhappy with the choices they had.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. available to them. 9% with the choices they made. In 1986, okay, mm-hmm. 20 years later, 37% of people felt unhappy with the choices they made. And so the question is, what's going on here? I mean, if the more choices we have, supposedly the happier we become. And it really boils down to sort of two explanations.
Okay.
When I have a lot of choice, I also must be in a mature position to manage that choice. If you give a child with little management skills 100 choices, you are not going to make a child happy. You're going to make him confused.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of the choices per se, but it's a matter of the child having internal control, management skills, if you will, to manage all of these choices, to say to 5 choices, no, I'm not going to do this.
Right.
And yes, I will do this. So the point is, we must acquire management skills along with having lots of choices. The more choices are available to us, the more management skills we must acquire to manage these choices wisely, so we end up being happy with the choices we made. But all the other stuff we have just talked about is, it seems like that the kids today have less management skills because they have less coping skills. And so on the one hand side, we have many, many more choices than we ever had before.
Right.
And on the other side, we have teenagers with less and less coping skills. The perfect combination for disaster.
Right.
So that's what I call the paradox of choice. You know, you go to a grocery store today and you can pick from probably 20 or 30 or 40 different kinds of potato chips. Now, when you were in elementary school, Alan, maybe you had 5 choices
right.
of potato chips. But that's where we're heading, and so that becomes a problem. And so I think sort of build in a dissatisfaction factor into our adolescents, where on the one hand side they lack coping skills and management skills, and on the other side, they have all of these choices and really don't know what choices they should make. Or if they make a choice, then they're unhappy with the choice, because then there's always other choices behind that choice.
Right, or there's always something better. I think that's,
exactly.
And that's part of it too. Now, let me ask you this, because I've thought of along the same lines, but can we set it up to where it becomes our channel of happiness? And what I mean by that is, in using your potato chip analogy, if there's 40 different brands out there, we can either be a person who likes, let's say that I like all of the potato chips except for the ones that have, spinach in them. All of the ones
right.
that are there, I like all of them, but I like some of them a little better. But I still like
right.
all of them. So I can get a sense of pleasure from all of those 39 out of 40. I can get a sense of pleasure, except for that one with spinach. Now,
right.
but on the other hand, instead of doing that, we seem to have gotten into a point of if there's 40 brands there and the brand that I like is not there. It's the one that's made in Hawaii and it's made special and it has a special oil in it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a person who, well, I can't be happy with any of those. So
exactly.
So what I'm saying is, why is it that we're somehow getting to a point where people are having a narrow channel of happiness versus
mm-hmm.
versus allowing choice to give us a huge channel for happiness? And maybe there's still a couple of things that wouldn't make us
no.
happy.
It's an excellent point. And of course, you can combine that with the identity formation of an adolescent who is not at the point where he has sort of decided, if you will, which potato chips I like the best. He hasn't really made that decision yet. So he is twittering and texting 25 of his friends
to get input,
getting him some feedback as to which one he should pick. Okay? Now you got the perfect storm.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
Now you got the perfect storm. In other words, the more opinions I get to help me form my opinions from my adolescents, the more confused I become and the less management skills and coping skills I develop.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's not like education. It's not like when you're twittering these people, they're not really educating you. They're giving their opinion. And they're just
It has nothing to do with education. Everything has to do with opinion.
That's right.
Or what's cool or what's hot or whatever it is. Yeah.
Wow.
And of course, you could be really liking that one potato chip that, you know, has that special oil from Hawaii. But three of my friends that I'm texting, they think it sucks. That thing sucks, and so I'm abandoning my real first choice, and I'm adopting the opinion of somebody else, even though I really emotionally don't agree with it.
Wow!
So I become a herd animal.
Yep. Yeah, and I've got a feeling we could do a whole nother show on herd animals.
Yes.
Let me ask you one more thing, and we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
But touch a little bit about the sexualization of youth and women, and I know it's something that people do know about, but give us something that's a little bit new in that area. And as I said, we're down to about 2.5-3 minutes.
Well, there isn't really anything new. It's just that the pop culture is feeding the pop culture, the money behind the pop culture is enriching themselves on the teens. Yeah, that's all there's to it.
Right.
And that's how they sell. That's how they market. It's all about money, and the fallout is particularly young women who the message is you have to be thin, you have to be sexy, young women come to look at themselves as something to be looked at instead of something that I can do in the world.
Right.
So I'm an object. I'm something to be looked at, as opposed to I am somebody that can do something in the world. And the pop culture is the number one culprit of what goes on in this industry. It's horrible.
Yeah. Well, Jared, I want to thank you for coming on. This has been great. I love the information. And again, if anybody wants to get a copy of this PowerPoint presentation, it's phenomenal. You can go to our site. We've got it there. You just click on Jared, and it's at www.answersforthefamilyblog.com, and you can get that. Jared, thank you so much for coming on, and keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you so much, Alan.
You're welcome. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Now, if everybody please join us next week. Well, let me make sure that we're off here. Anyway, join us next week for an important topic that touches the hearts of professionals and parents alike. Bleeding Hearts, Is Your Teen a Cutter? With Linda Mantel. And I also encourage you to listen and to share Answers for the Family with your family, your friends, and your associates who could benefit from the wealth of information provided by our guests. And if you go to our website, again, it's www.answers4thefamilyblog.com, you can listen to each of our shows as well as view information and links directly to our guests' websites. In addition, you can submit questions for upcoming guests and submit topic suggestions either for a topic or for a particular guest for this show. Now, until next week, seek to catch someone doing something good every day. I know I am.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.